In this lecture, we're going to talk about the two main concepts in this area of economics. The first is valuation. And as we'll see, valuation is the process by which decisions are made by you and I or any human person when engaged in action. And then the second concept is appraisement. And appraisement refers to the method by which the division of labor, or social interactions in production and consumption, are arranged in a like manner to the way in which we engage in valuation. And price, or price theory, is the intermediate step in between these two, ideas. So we start with valuation. This leads us then to price theory. Price theory is the basis for appraisement, for entrepreneurial decisions about what is valuable to produce and what arrangements of the factors of production will keep costs down in the division of labor. So let's start at the beginning with the concept of human action. Human action, we say, is purposeful behavior. By this we mean it's simply directed toward the attainment of an end. Or we could say that the desire to attain the end of action is the motive for acting. We could call this motivated behavior. Now, obviously, having an end in and of itself doesn't constitute action. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition. In order for action to occur, in addition to having an end, a person must first identify things that exist in the world that could be used as means to the attainment of this end. The person must be able to identify the causal connection between items that exist in the world and the attainment of his end. And then, in addition to this, with respect to means, a person must also control the use of these things. So it isn't enough just to identify that something could be used as a means, but the person must actually be able to control the use of it in action. So we might say that human action is applying means to attain ends. Now, economic theory begins with the fundamental axiom of economics that human action exists, or we could say that individuals act. This proposition is axiomatic, hence it's called an axiom. An axiomatic proposition is one that's self-evidently true, that in order to make any attempt to demonstrate the proposition false, you must assume that the proposition is true. So anyone who would attempt to show that human action does not exist would, in fact, be engaged in a human action with that as the end and applying certain means, you know, making a speech, writing a paper, whatever, just sitting and acting as if he were doing nothing. That would be an action, right? To try to prove this proposition wrong. So literally, this proposition can't be demonstrated wrong or false. And so it's called self-evidently true or axiomatically true. Now, as Rothbard points out, there's also another important step in starting economic theory from this fundamental axiom, which is to recognize that a lot of what we know about human action is understood by us reflectively. It's understood by us because we're human beings who do, in fact, engage in action. And because of this, we understand already the fundamental principles of acting. We understand the difference, as soon as someone says it, between ends and means. We understand the connection between ends and means, that means are useful items that we employ to the attainment of an end. We understand value and cost. We understand success and failure. All of these basic concepts of what's bound up in the notion of human action are understood by us reflectively. And economic theory then begins with this reflective contemplation of what exactly is involved in action, what do we mean by these concepts, and then, of course, we begin to engage in the praxeological process of deducing what's implied from human action. Now, the first thing that we want to state about in this process of thinking through valuation is just maybe a clarification of our axiom that individuals act. Here, the clarification would be this, that only individuals act. The human person, in other words, is the acting entity. There is no other acting entity that engages in human action except the human person. Now, by this, we mean to dispel the possibility that there could be something like a collective entity that engages in acting. This we must set aside and commit to the trash heap when we think about economic theorizing. We must hew only to this principle that the individual is the entity of acting. Why? Because this is how we understand action. It's one of the first things we recognize about action when we begin to reflect upon it. Now, the problem that this raises for valuation comes, as I suggested already, in the intersection between how we engage in valuation for our own personal actions and how we engage in appraisement or the valuing of things, if you will, socially, when we interact socially. Some might suggest that we do the latter by just presuming that there's something like a collective entity of acting that values for us, or that somehow we collectively value things, and therefore we can just use valuation of this collective entity in the same manner that we would use valuation for the individual person to decide in the social realm as we do in the realm of our personal action. This will not do. We have to grapple with the hard, difficult question of how we reconcile our different valuations in the social order. It's easy, again, to see how we engage in valuing things to make our own personal decisions. It's not so easy to see when our values conflict. I want chocolate ice cream, you want vanilla. How we get the ice cream maker to satisfy the higher valued preference. So this becomes the major theoretical puzzle, the question that we have to address in thinking through this interface between value and appraisement. And if you're already trained in economics, you're thinking ahead, of course. You can see how price theory does this, the theory of demand and supply, based upon preferences leading to prices, which lead then to appraisement. This is what we wish to cover this morning. Now, the second thing we want to just claim here, and then we'll start the process of deduction about valuation, is that means are scarce. That is, not enough means are available to satisfy all of our ends in any particular instance of acting. So action implies, of course, that some of our ends are unmet. But if some of our ends are unmet, then obviously our means are scarce. If we had sufficient means to satisfy all of our ends, well, this is what we would do. But since we don't do this or can't do this because of the finitude of our existence, means are scarce to us. Now, it follows from this, of course, that action, since we do in fact act in the face of this scarcity of means, it must be the case that we choose when we act. Or as economists say, we allocate our means. We choose between attaining one end and attaining another end with any particular scarce means. If we couldn't do this, of course, we wouldn't be able to act at all. In the face of scarcity, we would just sit dumbfounded, not able to apply our means in any direction. It also needs to be kept in mind that choice, when we make a choice in acting, this choice is always two-dimensional. And so there's always a comparison that's being made between things in our minds when we engage in valuation. We're always comparing the value of one thing, one course of action, one end, to the value of another course of action or another end. This is where we then get to the principle of preference. And this is the, we might say, basic concept of valuing in economics. So by preference, we just mean an ordinal rank, a rank order of the value that we place on different ends, or we can obviously we can value means as well. But it's important to go beyond this to point out the subtle points with respect to preference. Remember, we said that when we think initially about human action, we need to do this reflectively. We need to think in a contemplative way about our own actions. What it mean, you know, think about an action and what it means to make a judgment of value in our minds and establish a preference. And it should be clear that in this sense, preference must always be understood as part of the action. Preference is always bound up in the action itself. It's important to say this because mainstream economists tend to view preference as independent from action. Preference to them is a preference map. It's an indifference map, a utility function, right? It's some sort of some sort of thing that exists over here that decides for us. And so we act according to this map of our preferences. Or as Paul Samuelson would put it, as we act day by day, we reveal our preferences over time, right? As if our preferences were this map of values that's superimposed upon our actions and we conform robotically to them. That's not the idea, at least not in the Austrian tradition. The idea is that preference is simply the valuing choice that we make in action itself. It's the mental judgment of value that is associated with that action and not another one. Another action, then, well, that's based upon another preference that we establish in our mind. Okay, so we prefer Murray Rothbard's phrase here of demonstrated preference. This is what Murray likes to call this a feature of preference, that our preference is demonstrated when we act. It's not that it's, superimposed upon us and then revealed by a sequence of actions, but each time we act, we demonstrate a preference. We're choosing one thing over another. Now, two other points about value that we want to cover here. The first is that value is subjective. And by subjective, we mean that value is an intensive state of mind. It exists in our mind. It has no extensive property that exists outside of our mind. And therefore, nothing objective can be said about it. We can't define a unit of it. We can't measure it. We can't apply arithmetic operations to it. Because it's locked within our mind. And so without the ability to for different people to objectively examine our value, there isn't any way to come up with something like a common unit of valuing. This distinguishes the Austrian view from the mainstream, where it's very common to talk about utils. You know, the unit of value. So I eat a chocolate ice cream cone and I get 8 utils of value. So this again is certainly outside the realm of the Austrian way of thinking about value. This presupposes that value is like a substance. Right? It's like a water in a pitcher or something that we can measure and divide and perform arithmetic operations with. Whereas the subjectivity of value means that this type of operation is impossible. This also means, by the way, that we cannot apply arithmetic operations using units of value to answer the question that we posed at the beginning of how we reconcile our individual valuations in the social setting. We can't just add them up and to say, oh, that's the social value of something. This again is a mainstream project. Some mainstream economists have taken up this project trying to do, say, welfare theory with on the basis of utils that we add up. But actually, it's simply more difficult than that. The fact of the matter is that there has to be this transitional step, as Mises pointed out, between the value we have in our mind and the appraisement that entrepreneurs do of the value of things in the social setting. Now, the other thing that I want to mention about value, because this is a separable point, it's often confused in the mainstream literature with subjectivity, is that value also is not constant. So value is not, value is subjective or not objective, and value is not constant. What this means fundamentally is that there isn't a quantitatively constant relationship between external circumstances and my valuation of them. I can like a chocolate ice cream cone more one day than another. Or I could even imagine at the time that I consume the chocolate ice cream, at the moment that I'm acting, that the value of it could have been different to me. By the way, we recognize this immediately when we reflect upon our action in the concept of regret. Right? Why would we have the idea that we regret an action if we didn't think it possible not to have done the action in the face of the same circumstances? Oh, I regret going on that blind date. Oh, I regret eating, the chocolate ice cream instead of the vanilla. So this seems to be a reasonable proposition that we recognize again immediately just from simple reflection about acting. So if value is not constant, then of course there can be no mathematical functions of value. To have a mathematical function, we have to have constants and variables. But with valuing, we just have variables. We don't know what the constants, the quantitative constants of some functional form of value would be. This, of course, rules out utility functions immediately. The possibility of erecting such a thing if there are no constants. Now, here's where we get to the point of seeing why we have to separate out these two elements of value, the subjectivity of it from the lack of constants or the variability of it. Because mainstream economists say, well, okay, we can follow you up to this point in certain respects, but with regard to the subjectivity of things, we don't believe in interpersonal utility comparisons either, just like you guys. And okay, so we might have a few stray dogs that did the welfare theory or whatever, but they're sort of nutty and we forget about them. That's all history, and we don't do that kind of thing anymore. We have indifference curves and other apparati like that that avoid this sort of thing. But what they do claim is that even the ones who don't claim that there's something like utility functions do claim that there's something like demand functions. Why? Well, with a demand function, you do have cardinal numbers, right? You have prices. You have quantities of the good. These are cardinal numbers. You can perform arithmetic operations with these things, right? There's no lack of objectivity here. And so they move immediately from the existence of objective things to work with, prices and quantities, to functional forms. But the missing step, obviously, is you still have to have constants. If you're going to draw a demand function, you're going to formulate a demand function, there have to be constants and variables. Where are the constants? If demand comes from utility, if we demand things because we prefer them, and our preferences are not constant but variable, well, then there are no demand functions, or supply functions, for that matter. If supply functions also are based upon preferences. So these two are separate aspects of the nature of value. Now, as I mentioned, the mainstream economists attempt to get around these difficulties of erecting, let's say, functional treatments of utility and demand and supply in two different ways. And we won't take the time in this lecture to talk about these. This will be the topic of the lecture that I do on Wednesday. Here, we just want to lay out what the Austrians say without treating these critical questions. But let me just tell you what these are. The first is quantitative representations of ordinal ranks. So they just arbitrarily assign numbers to ordinal ranks, and they say, then we can work with these numbers, and again, we'll criticize that on Wednesday. And the other is indifference curves. I've mentioned this already, so some of you with a background in economics know about indifference curves. I won't say anything else about those. We'll take that up again on Wednesday. Okay, now, just to continue our line of thought about value, as we said before, when we engage in allocating or choosing, it's always a comparison of value. Action is always motivated, if you will, by a value difference. People recognize that something more valuable can be attained by giving up something of less value. Value differences are what are behind our personal action. They're what's behind exchange. Right? We have reverse preferences of the double coincidence of wants, right? And we engage in exchange to exploit this. And all other actions that one can imagine are always based upon this simple principle of choice and preference. So this means that every action has a value, what we aim to attain, and a cost, what we forego, the value of the alternative that we forego. And likewise, then, with value, cost is a subjective, and cost is variable. It's not constant. Cost is just the subjective value of the alternative foregone. This comparing of the value and the cost of options in acting also implies the concept of profit or net benefit, that every action aims at a profit. Profit isn't a concept invented by the capitalist exploiters. It's inherent in the nature of human existence. We all aim at profit or net benefit in every action that we take. We aim at something of higher value. We forego something of lesser value. Now, we can say something even more exact about the way that we pursue profit. And this is the principle that Mises liked to dwell upon. We might say that this is the mode of human acting, and he called this principle economizing, that in human action we economize. And by this he means that with given means at our disposal, we aim to attain higher valued ends and forego lesser valued ends. And then for any end that we're striving to attain, we strive to attain it with lower valued means, so that we can reserve the higher valued means to attain other ends of value to us. So this is economizing. Notice again, there are two dimensions to it, the valuing of the end and the valuing of the mean. So in every action, we always, all of our personal actions, we always economize with respect to the values in our minds, the judgment of value in our mind at that time, with respect to the options available to us. And then the final thing, the concept I want to talk about with respect to valuation is what we call imputed value. And imputed value is the principle that value, as we've already pointed out, begins logically in our mind. And so when we think about the logic of acting, value is in our mind. And then we place value on the means that we believe will aid us in the attainment of the end that we value. And then if those means are, if it takes a further step of production to create those means, if we have a distinction between consumer goods and producer goods, then we impute value to the producer goods from the value of the consumer good as aids to making that consumer good that then has value in satisfying our end. So we might have a little schematic. It would look like this. So value begins in the mind, and then it moves to consumer goods. And then to producer goods. So this is the direction of imputation. Now, remember, this argument about imputation simply follows from the distinction between ends and means, and this discussion we've had of value already, that every act of production, every use of a means, is to attain a consumptive end. And what is the value of the consumptive end? Well, it's in our mind. We judge this in our mind. Now, let me say one other subtle point about this, so we won't pursue this particular point. That in later lectures, a lot of the gaps, this is kind of a framework, and then a lot of the specifics, if there are any gaps here, will be filled in. But one might say in response to this, well, this doesn't seem quite right, how there seems to be a time delay between the mind placing value on the consumer good and then to the factors of production. I mean, doesn't the time sequence have to run the other way? Don't you have to have the factors of production that produce the consumer good, and then the mind can value this? So what do you do about this? It seems like these two things would not coexist. And the answer to this puzzle that the Austrians give is expectations, speculation. Right? The difference between anticipated value and realized value. And so if a person is valuing some producer good now, he can do this without waiting for the consumer good to be produced from it, because he can anticipate what the value will be once the production is complete. So I want to have a chocolate ice cream cone, and I have the back at the game day apartment, I have the chocolate ice cream, a little container of it, right, and a scoop, and a cone, and these are my producer goods, the refrigerator, and so on. And so I don't have to actually make the cone and then consume it to have in my mind the notion of anticipated value, what I believe I will attain in terms of the value of realizing this end, to then value the factors of production, to value the ice cream, to know that I want to go buy it or to buy the ice cream cones and so on. So entrepreneurial expectations are what make this reconciliation, and there'll be much said about this later, in later lectures. Now, let me also use this little schematic just to point out what the alternative arguments are from this imputation view that have been given by other economists, other schools of thought. The classical economists tended to hold to a cost of production theory. And notice a cost of production theory would just reverse these, reverse these arrows. Reverse the arrows, right? So we'd say something like value is inherent in the producer goods. Labor has a certain intrinsic value or inherent value. And then through the act of production, that value is transmitted to the consumer good. And then somehow the mind recognizes this value. It acquiesces in this value. It says, oh, well, obviously the value of the good must, in fact, be $10. The value of the, you know, a book that I buy must be $10 because it has the $10 of labor value embedded in it. You know, it's just when I state the theory this way, it should seem rather implausible to you. The only even plausible step would be the production step, right? It seems completely implausible that once having been produced, my mind must acquiesce to the value of the good. By value here, we mean price. That I must say in my mind, oh yes, the book is in fact has a value of $10, or the ice cream cone does in fact have a value of $2. It seems highly unlikely that such a thing would exist. This is one of the reasons why the classical school didn't deal very effectively with utility. Oh, okay, well, they sort of have half of a theory in a way. Now, the other theory, the neoclassical theory, does this. It tries to redirect the arrows inward like this, right? It says value is the value of a consumer good is, whoa, what'd I do? Chad, what'd I do? Okay, so the value of the consumer good is jointly determined. It's co-determined by the subjective value in our minds and the intrinsic value of the factors of production. The factors of production do, in fact, have something like inherent value. And yet these things, you know, the two blades of the scissor, Marshallian scissors, right? Demand and supply. So supply is based upon the hard reality of the value of the factors, and demand upon our utility. Now, again, it should seem from our previous discussion that this is entirely implausible. How are these two? What if these two don't match up? What if the intrinsic production values of things, what if my mind doesn't agree with them? Then doesn't something have to give? And of course, what gives in this system is my mind. See, the intrinsic properties of the world, they don't give, right? My mind has to give. I have to adjust my mental value of the thing. I have to slide down my demand curve, adjusting my mental value of the thing until it adjusts to the costs. That tends to be the standard treatment here. Okay, now, so these are a couple alternatives. Now, let me briefly then mention about appraisement as we turn our attention there. Let's just start with the definition. So appraisement is the valuing, is also a process of valuing, but it's a valuing of a particular type, where instead of valuing just in our mind, we use an artifice, if you will, a makeshift, a technique of valuing. As Mises says, appraisement opens up an avenue for reason that doesn't exist without it. It's sort of like calculus in this sense. Once we have the apparatus of calculus, we can solve all sorts of problems with our mind that we couldn't solve without it. And appraisement does the same thing. Economic calculation is a similar kind of makeshift, if you will, invention, whatever word we might use to apply to it. And it rests upon, the technique it rests upon is arithmetic computation with monetary entries. And the two fundamental monetary entries are net income, right? Net income is the difference between revenues and costs of production, and net worth, the difference between the assets, the market value of assets and the market value of liabilities. And obviously, once you recognize these right away when I write them out, entrepreneurs make production decisions using net income, how to allocate the factors of production, what goods to produce, what are valuable enough, what have revenues high enough to cover the costs. And they make investment decisions, how to invest their capital on the basis of net worth, to build a new plant, to build up their inventories, purchase new equipment, and so on. So the decisions by the entrepreneurs in the division of labor rely upon appraisement, which in turn relies upon this technique of economic calculation, arithmetic computation, using arithmetic, right? Adding and subtracting, having cardinal numbers, objective entries that can be used here. Now, let me just briefly cover why it's not possible for valuation to substitute for appraisement, and then we'll go through the argument about the link between the two. Well, remember, if we're going to economize, what we need to do is somehow objectively choose between competing ends so that we're choosing the more valued and set aside the less valued. You and I can do this in our own minds easily. So I choose chocolate instead of vanilla ice cream, whatever the choice might be. But when we enter into society in a division of labor where we're not self-sufficient but producing for the consumptive ends of other people, well, then we have to make value comparisons. Right? So if I open up an ice cream shop, then it's not my value of the chocolate and the vanilla that counts anymore. It's my customers. It's consumers at large. Well, some will want chocolate, some will want vanilla. I can't directly experience their subjective values to determine it that way, right? Because they're subjective. And I can't compare them directly. I can't just ask them, you know, which one of you, the chocolate customer or the vanilla customer, has the greatest preference. I mean, this won't give me an objective result. So I can't objectively compare these values. So I'm stuck, right? Valuation just won't aid me. I can't proceed in this way to determine objectively which is the higher valued end. And likewise, of course, a similar problem would exist for means. If I try to determine the lower cost means, I have a similar problem. In a division of labor, the suppliers of my materials, I have this little ice cream shop, so I'm buying, you know, different products from other suppliers. I buy the cones from one guy and freezers from another and so on and so forth, the ingredients for making the ice cream. I have to decide between them. Who should, you know, I purchase these products from? Who would keep my opportunity costs down in the division of labor? Well, once again, I can't know this by personal experience. That's why we have a division of labor, so that we don't have to personally experience every production activity in the division of labor and value it individually. And I can't rely upon these potential suppliers to make an objective comparison of their own valuations. They can't do this. Right? The subjectivity of value precludes this. Okay, so let me just give a schematic then of how, in the Austrian view, theory would go with respect to reconciling these things. So we start with preferences at the top. So preferences are the logically first. And then from here we get the supply of goods. And the demand for goods. And as everybody knows, supply and demand come together, we get prices. Prices of the goods imply costs for the consumers and revenue for the entrepreneurs. And then revenue for the entrepreneurs is the basis for demand for the factors. Supply of the factors comes, once again, just from preferences. Demand and supply give us prices. Prices of the factors give us costs for the entrepreneurs. And income for the factor owners. Okay, so that's a schematic that covers all of price theory. Right? The upper part is for consumer goods. And then the lower part for the prices of the factors of production. And then once we have the theory of price, we can explain economic calculation and appraisement. So this is really the point of going through this exercise. Okay, so now what we want to do, the last thing we want to do is just outline the Austrian theory of price of consumer goods. This first part, start with preferences, go to supply and demand, and then the prices of goods. Okay, so to do this, we have to establish first what Rothbard calls the two laws of utility. And these are established by making certain implications, certain logical implications, as we've spoken about before, from the action of buying and selling. And so they're derived, and more specifically, the laws of supply and demand are derived directly from the two principles we talked about before of economizing and imputation. But there is one technical point that has to be kept in mind. There is one assumption, we might say. The laws of supply and demand then are formulated in what we might call a mental experiment, where we make a certain assumption in order to draw out the laws. Remember, we said before that since our preferences are variable, we wouldn't think there's any statement, law-like statement, that we could make about them. And in order to make a statement like this, we need some kind of a conjecture. Now, this conjecture, of course, must be reasonable. We must be able to apply it to the real world. It must be a realistic kind of claim. Okay, now, this assumption or conjecture is this: that action is taking place with equally serviceable units of a good. Now, equally serviceable units of a good would be a condition where any one unit of a good, a unit of a good is just an amount of it. So any one unit of a good can satisfy any one end to which it would be put. Now, it is true that action doesn't always exist with this condition. Sometimes we act when there aren't equally serviceable units. In such a case, then, well, there are no laws of utility. The laws of utility would only apply where this condition does in fact exist, or it can be conjectured to exist. It can be reasonably conjectured to exist. Now, you notice that we can in fact reasonably conjecture that this exists ubiquitously in markets. This is because the way that we find goods for sale in markets is not only in equally serviceable units, but in physically identical units. So you go to the gas station, every gallon of 87 octane gas, it's all the same. Or to the ice cream store, and every chocolate ice cream cone, it's all the same. You go to the grocery store, every loaf of Wonder Bread, well, it's physically identical, not just equally serviceable. It's an even more strict condition. And in fact, if we look at prices that exist on goods in the world, we'll find that they exist only for these sorts of units of things, right? There's a price for 87 octane gas, a price for the chocolate ice cream cone, a price for the Wonder Bread, and so on. There aren't prices for gasoline or prices for ice cream or nondescript goods, right? They're prices only for units of goods. And typically they're offered to us in multiple units that are physically the same. You go to the car dealer, and there's a whole slew of cars sitting on the lot that are identical. You could order an identical one. Now, let me use this as an example to illustrate then how the theory works once we see that this condition is applicable. Let's say we have this guy, and he owns a 2-year-old Honda Civic, and we know that the principle of economizing says that he applies it to the highest valued end. Whatever we actually see him using it for, that would be the highest end. And let's say, just to have a simple case, let's say it's commuting. So he drives it to work or he drives it to school. So that's his use, right? This is what he's doing with it. And then we know through the theory of imputation, the concept of imputation, that he then imputes a certain value to this Civic based upon the value of the end that that he's using, it helps attain for him. And we know that this, since his end is his higher valued end, that the value he places on that Civic would have the highest value that a Civic could have for him. And, okay, so then we say, well, what if there were equally serviceable units of these cars? What, in other words, if he had another Honda Civic, a second one? Well, okay, so if he had a second one, obviously he would have to apply that to the next highest ranking end, right? He could, he already satisfies his first end of commuting fully with one car. So the second car must be applied to something less valuable. Let's say he lets his friends use it. So he just, first come, first serve, he leaves the keys in it, and they just come and use it during the day. So that's his second most valued use. Well, then he imputes less value to that car. He imputes less value to the car because it's attaining for him a less valued end. Notice physically identical cars, but the value of the two is different. This is the key insight. Right? With physically identical things, we place different value on them. If this were not the case, if we didn't have diminishing marginal utility, well, then our behavior in the market would be very difficult to explain. It would be very difficult to explain, for example, why if I go to an ice cream store and I buy a chocolate ice cream cone because I value it more than the money, why I don't buy a second one and a third one and a fourth one and a fifth one and a sixth one? Well, it must be because my value is changing, right? The value of this, even though the ice cream cones are identical, there's a different value I place on the second one than the first. It must be true. Otherwise, I would, in fact, buy the second if it had the same value. The same is true of money, right? The diminishing marginal utility applies to money, too. So we have it working in both directions, if you will, in demand and supply. Okay, so this is our first law of utility, right? Diminishing marginal utility. The larger the stock of a good, the lower the value rank of the marginal unit, the least valued unit. And the second law of utility, as Rothbard gives it to us, is just that the larger the stock of a good, a larger stock of a good is preferred to a smaller stock. More of a good is preferred to less. So as long as something is still a good, if you have more units of it, you can satisfy more ends, and that would be preferable. Now, of course, the laws of supply and demand then follow directly from this, from these laws of utility. Let's say we have a market now for Honda Civics. What happened? Keep bumping those buttons. Okay, so let's say we have a market with different buyers. The reason we want to introduce condition is that we want to allow for the possibility of competition. In other words, different valuations that different people place upon the same good. Now, why this? Well, of course, this too is just an empirical part of reality. We just recognize in the world that different people value things differently. And notice if this is true, then when they come into markets, they'll be in a position to compete against each other. So we get the principle of competitive bidding from the inherent differences that we have in the value of things that we place in our minds relative to money. So let's say buyer A has preferences that look like this. And buyer B is somewhat less eager to buy a Civic. So the HC is a Honda Civic, so that's one Honda Civic. This is the two-year-old Honda Civic used market. So buyer A and buyer B, and then let's say buyer C is the least eager of the three. So there's a stratification. And then, of course, the principle of diminishing marginal utility says that gives us the law of demand, right? It says that only at lower prices would it be possible for any one of these buyers to have purchased more than one unit. Why is this so? Because since the second unit has less value, the person is only willing to pay a lower price to obtain it, right, as opposed to the first unit. So this is what gives us this law of diminishing marginal utility, is what gives us the law of demand. And then we could see that the similar thing would be true of sellers. So let's say we have the seller side of the market, And let's make seller X the most eager seller. So no, seller X would be willing to sell his Honda Civic for $11,000, right? He'd take that amount of money over his Civic. And let's make seller Y a little less eager to sell. And seller Z the least eager. And so we can see in this market then that we would get this particular condition. So let's say if the price were $15,000 and there would be one demanded, this is by buyer A, but all three sellers would want to sell, right? And then at lower prices, because of the law of demand, well, the quantity demanded increases. It stays the same at 14, but the quantity supplied is reduced, and so on. So the chart would look like this. Okay, so you'll notice that the law of supply is just the companion principle to the law of demand, right? It's still based upon diminishing marginal utility. It just says that only at higher prices would the seller be willing to sell more than he actually sold at whatever the market price happens to be. Why is this so? Because the seller gives up the lesser valued units of the means and retains for himself the higher valued units. And so only at higher prices can you bid those higher valued units away from him. So the law of supply and demand then imply what Austrians like to call the market clearing price. The market clearing price, this price, $13,000, where the quantity demand and the quantity supplied are the same. So the very last thing, let me just make the argument about why this price and not others persists in the market. So the reason that prices conform to the market clearing condition where the quantity demand and the quantity supply are the same is because this is the condition, the only condition, the only price, in other words, that exists in the market where the preferences of all the participants in the market are satisfied. At any other price, someone is unsatisfied, dissatisfied with the result. Someone's preferences are not fully satisfied at any of these other prices, and therefore that person won't act in the way that he does to bring about that price. Right? The whole point of action is to satisfy our preferences, and so people never intentionally act in a way that their preferences are not satisfied. They don't ask prices that are too high, or offer prices that are too low. So notice again in our circumstance, in our particular concrete example, what would happen if this were so. Let's say sellers tried to hold out for a $15,000 price. Well, at that price, their preferences would not be satisfied, right? All three sellers want to sell at that price. Only one buyer wants to buy. All three sellers can't sell. Which one does? Well, let's say seller Z gets the sale. So he sells at the $15,000 price. But X and Y won't sit still for that. They won't sit still and watch the sale go to Z. They'll undercut him. They're perfectly willing to sell at a lower price, right? Seller Y is willing to sell at 13. Seller X is even willing to sell at 11. So they'll simply outbid him. And as they do, then all the preferences of the participants are satisfied. Seller Z does not want to sell his car at $13,000. And the same would work on the demand side, right? If buyers try to lowball and hold out for $11,000 or something, well, then we'll have three demanded and one supplied. Only one demander will have his preferences satisfied. The other two won't sit still for this. They won't just say, "Oh well, that's the brakes. Couldn't do any business today." No, they'll outbid this guy. They'll outbid the buyer who's offering a lower price. Bring in other sellers, right? And the market will clear it. Cars bought and sold. Now, let me just, for the very last thing, just remind you about, this theory looks somewhat standard, this kind of part of the presentation, right? But I should remind you, I think you heard this already in the previous lecture, that In the Austrian view, what we're explaining, what we're showing here, is what is going on behind actual prices in the market. This is the immediate run, right? This is the actual in-time immediate price of something. So why the price at the gas station right now in town is 285 for 87 octane, or whatever it happens to be. These are not hypothetical prices. They're not prices as they would be in the long run under perfect competition or something. These are actual market prices. The actual price of something in the market clears the market. And why does it do this? Well, it does this because of demand and supply. Where does demand and supply come from? It comes from our preferences. It comes from our intentions to bring this about. And then the final thing, it's these particular prices then that are relevant for appraisement. It's not hypothetical long-run prices, right? What entrepreneurs need to know are what are prices now? And based upon what they know about prices now, they can formulate expectations about what prices will be in the future when they engage in production and then try to sell their goods into the future. And so it's these prices that are the basis for appraisement. Okay, at this point I'll stop. So thank you.